happiness. Rob will be back next weekend with a typically eclectic and toothsome mix of music, with no doubt some treasures from the archive. Thanks for your company this morning, and do join Rob next Sunday at the usual time of 9 o'clock.
Sunday Morning with James Jolly is a unique production for BBC Radio 3, with studio production this morning by Neil Miners.
Saturday matinees at the BBC Proms. In 1952, our Proms anniversary composer Benjamin Britten heard a piece in which seven modern French composers had each written a variation on a theme by the 17th century composer Compre. Britten thought about doing a British version, and why not on a tune like Selinger's Round, which would be ideal for a new collective tribute to the new Queen Elizabeth. Imogen Holst, Lennox Barclay, Michael Tippett, William Walton, and now, 60 years after the coronation, the English Chamber Orchestra adds two new variations to that set. I'm Clemency Burton-Hill. Join me for a new take on an intriguing set of variations. Saturday afternoon at the BBC Proms from 3 o'clock.
Well, now on BBC Radio 3, Private Passions, and Michael Barclay's guest is the Chief Medical Officer for England, Dame Professor Sally Davis.
Sally Davis appears on our television screens almost every week. As the government's chief medical officer, we rely on her authority in every health crisis, be it horse meat in burgers, antibiotic resistance, embryos with three parents. Named recently as one of the most powerful women in the country, she's also Director General of the National Institute of Health Research, which has an annual budget of £1 billion. But the strange thing is that we're so focused on what she's saying, we often don't notice the woman who's speaking. And indeed, if you Google Dame Professor Sally Davis, you find almost nothing about her personal life, who she really is. In fact, Sally, you don't usually give interviews like this one. And I wonder whether that's deliberate, that you feel it's part of the job to be anonymous.
Yes, it is deliberate. The role is the important thing about helping the nation get to grips with the issues, trying to make sure we do the right response. And I've watched other people in public life and wondered why they expose their families. And my family have been very supportive about what I do, my husband and children, but on condition that I don't take them to work as well, that they have their privacy, that it won't be like Blair's son drunk in the road. So I do talk about the work rather than me. But I suppose I'm also a bit shy.
So as Chief Medical Officer, do you sometimes feel that you need to appear virtuous and healthy? I mean, perhaps not reach for the second glass of wine when you're in public, for example.
Absolutely. Actually, I have improved since I became Chief Medical Officer. I've never hidden the fact I enjoy a glass of wine, but I try not to be photographed now with one. And I do drink less because I've read the evidence and I am persuaded of it. And we women can't drink a lot. We can only take half the alcohol that you men can in your livers. So I'm much more careful than I used to be.
Perhaps in that case, it's even more important to be able to indulge in another vice, i.e. music.
Absolutely.
How important is that to you?
For me, music has played a very important role throughout my life. I played the violin and the viola all through school, and I loved it. It was the thing that I quite excelled at school. I didn't excel academically at that stage. And I could pick up my violin, and if I was in a bad temper, I'd make a bad noise. But I couldn't make a bad noise because that's wrong. And I always put it down feeling better, feeling calmed. I used to play in the Midland Youth Orchestra. I played quartets. I loved it. But I had to make a choice, so I went for science.
So the first piece of music, I think it's something you played when you were a teenager.
Yes, I came across Vaughan Williams through playing in the Midland Youth Orchestra, the theme on Thomas Tallis, and I went looking for other music, and I found this. ¶¶
I expect there might be many amongst our listeners who are just saying, I kind of recognise that, but not quite sure, because you don't hear it that often. It has a very English flavour, doesn't it?
It does, yes.
And a kind of slightly wistful, lyrical quality, little bit of folk song in there. So it's no surprise, perhaps, that it's Vaughan Williams, the suite for viola and small orchestra. And there we heard wonderful viola player Lawrence Power and the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Martin Brabbins. One of the things I always think about the viola, and I don't know if you felt this when you were playing it, is that it has a slightly melancholy, yearning quality, a slightly darker quality than a violin.
Yes. I always saw it as the Cinderella of the orchestra. And generally we were playing chug, chug, chug. And then occasionally, and Vaughan Williams was very good at this, you'd get a theme that was just so beautiful to play. And when it did soar, it was wonderful.
Britten was very good at it too, because he was an amateur viola player. So he made sure that his viola parts were quite interesting.
I hadn't known that, though I remember playing the Simple Symphony, of course. And I got into Vaughan Williams through Greensleeves as well.
There was a little touch at the end of that passage, which I thought sounded very like that, and a bit like the lark ascending and that other great bits of British music. So, Sally Davis, you gave up playing an instrument under the very considerable pressures of training to be a doctor in Manchester. It does tend to squeeze almost everything else out of your life for that period, doesn't it?
It does, and I was very lively in student politics. I tried dinghy sailing. I sailed for the men's first team as a crew. I tried the Manchester Orchestra, but somehow, because I wasn't in music, it didn't work. Did I not have enough commitment? I don't know, but they seemed to be turning their nose up at me. I remember my teacher when I was in my teens saying, it doesn't matter, Sally, if you don't make music your life, because you'll always have it. And I think that's true. We always come back to music, don't we?
Absolutely. Once it's there, as they say in the blood, it remains. That was a difficult period for you because you'd been married, and it put a lot of pressure on that as well, didn't it?
After I left Manchester, I married and I went off to Spain as a diplomat's wife, which turned out not to be the ideal job for me. I did learn the violin there too. I was taught by a maestro who was wonderful, except that, of course, I wanted to play music and make music, and he wanted me to do exercises. And once I'd done them in one key in first position, I had to do them in the next key. And after I'd done every key, I was allowed the second position and up to the sixth. And that somehow was not the ideal way for me. So I gave up again, which is an eternal sadness, but I listen.
So your first marriage broke down and you came back to this country and started work in a hospital with a speciality, I think, in mind.
Well, when I started medicine, I didn't have a vocation, and giving it up for 4 years, I realised I did. I wanted to look after patients. And by a process of elimination and different jobs, I realised I was better if I was super specialised. And I specialised in sickle cell disease and inherited anaemia, predominantly in black people, so sub-Saharan Africa, the Caribbean, but also Arabs and Indians, and went to work at Central Middlesex Hospital in Brent with a big population. And it allowed me to look after 2-3 generations of families, but really get in depth into the issues and the subject for them.
Well, going into the darkness next, in Beethoven's Fidelio, Florestan is in prison. And I think this has various resonances for you, Sally.
So I chose this aria, not only because of its beauty, I particularly like the oboe bit, but also it reminds me of my second husband, and we played it a lot as we drove through the countryside in France the summer before he died of leukaemia.
Thank you.
Do you see that music, Sally Davis, essentially as being a very dark piece, or do you see hope and light in it?
I think it starts dark and then it discovers hope and light. And I suppose that's what I find so beautiful, that even if it is in his imagination that he sees Leonora, there is that sight, that vision that holds him up and lifts him up.
It's a bit like the prisoners coming into the light in the famous chorus, isn't it? That when they glimpse it, there's that wonderment, and he sees it in his inner mind.
Yes, and I wandered between the two, but actually it's the oboe piece that makes this so special.
Now that was Florestan's aria from Act Two of Beethoven's Fidelio. Jonas Kaufmann with the Mahler Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Claudio Abbado. So your husband Philip sadly died less than a year after you married. How did that change you as a doctor?
I fear that as a society we've lost the ability to talk about death. No, I don't fear. We have. We have a cultural problem with death. You talk to people, they haven't seen dead bodies. They shun it. My experience that demonstrated that was going back to work after Philip's funeral and being surrounded by silence. And in the end, having to say to the laboratory I worked in, OK, guys, I know you care. Thank you for that, and let's just get on as normal. I had to do it for them, not them for me. And I've watched people die and realised how important physical touch is as we depart this world. And we don't talk about it.
Your colleagues were rather surprised, weren't they, when you put your arms around somebody who was actually very close to death?
Yes, I was on a ward round as the consultant leading it, and a patient wasn't well, and he seemed to need something, but we couldn't work out what medically, and I sat down on the bed. I was a young woman in my early 30s, and he was an old man in his 70s, and I put an arm round him, and he just leant on me, and everyone disappeared off the ward round with embarrassment, and I sat there for 5-10 minutes and then helped him into bed, and left knowing I'd given him some peace. I was surprised that he died an hour later, but at least I gave him some peace. But then I had to round everyone up for the ward round going on, and there was kind of, why did you do that? And I said, because we're people. We're here to help people.
Do you still think that that's a lesson we could learn more about simply human contact?
Yes, I think we reduce death to something quite clinical. We're making a big effort to help people die at home. Philip died at home, my second husband, and it was a very special experience. We took him home and had him at home for 10 days actually lots of laughter, lots of fine wine, though he didn't taste it very well, but it was his fine wine and he wanted us to enjoy it. And there was a lot of happiness as well as the sadness of the departure.
And in fact, this next piece is very much for him, isn't it?
It is, yes.
Tell us about it.
Well, I actually heard it afterwards. I was introduced to opera by my parents quite young. I think the first opera I went to, I was 11. I went to Glyndebourne first when I was 24. And so when I could, I went to Wexford. And I discovered that at Wexford, you not only get opera, but you're enveloped in music. I loved it. And I heard this Stabat Mater there in the church, and it was enveloping, and it made me think about death and again.
And the words, of course, the Stabat Mater is about the Mother of God and what she has to go through watching her son. This is cuius animum gementem, through her heart, his sorrow sharing, all his bitter anguish bearing. Now at length the sword has passed. Oh, how sad and sore distressed was that mother, highly blessed, of the sole begotten one.
Thank you.
a description of Mary weeping at the foot of the cross from Rossini's Stabat Mater. I thought of two things, Sally, while we were listening to that. One was that you can never divorce the operatic composer from setting a religious text. So, for example, you know, one thinks of the Verdi Requiem, one thinks of the Britain War Requiem, one thinks there, and this is, after all, is a kind of requiem of Rossini's Stabat Mater. But there's that sense of drama, isn't there, and that sort of lyrical aria that you might expect in an opera.
Yes, and the other thing I thought was amazing how Christianity is the great religion, what it has stimulated in terms of music and art. I mean, my father was an expert on church architecture. He was a theologian. And it was a bad summer if we didn't see at least 100 churches and cathedrals, let alone every museum going, and the Ravenna mosaics, all these things stimulated by Christianity.
The other thing I thought was, you know, you mentioned viola chuntering, Isn't it extraordinary how composers like Donizetti, Bellini, Rossini, even with something that is ostensibly devastatingly sad, have that and yet manage to bring it off?
The modern continuo, yes, yes. And I remember being told, no, don't make it boring, you have to make it interesting, but it mustn't be operatic, yes.
And talking of operatic, I couldn't help noticing how Antonio Pappano, who, after all, is director of the Royal Opera House, music director, left that pause before he brought that theme back. And you're sitting there wanting it, aren't you?
Yes.
You know it's coming, and he made you wait and wait.
Yes.
Cuius animum gementem, from Rossini's Stabat Mater, Lawrence Brownlee with the Orchestra dell'Accademia Nazionale di Santa Cecilia, conducted, as I said, by Pappano. Now, we'll come on to drugs later, because that's very much a part of your brief. But some people, Sally, think that Wagner is a drug.
Right. Yes, well, again, my parents were clearly, as for all of us, very important. And my father loved Wagner, so I was brought up with bits of it being played initially on vinyl, as we'd call it now, and then later on CD. And they went off to Bayreuth when I was in my teens and came back having been enveloped and thought it was wonderful. I, in fact, twisted every arm I knew for 3 years and managed 10 years ago to get a pair of Ring Cycle tickets to take my husband for his 50th in Bayreuth. It was wonderful. We arrived and he said, I'm not sure I really like Wagner. And I was listening, oh, well, you should always give presents that you want to receive. But actually, he loved it too. I mean, it is all enveloping there, isn't it?
You have to submit to it.
Yes, and we're about to again, because we thought it was such fun. We said, what do you do to get more tickets? And they said, apply every year, and in 14, 15 years. But 10 years later, a fat envelope came through the door.
You've chosen the love duet from Tristan and Isolde. And, of course, this opera was really pivotal in that it moved the whole language of music on, that the harmony was new right from the very opening chord. But why did you choose this?
I think most of the music I go out to see at the here at the moment is actually opera, because it's all enveloping and you have to book it months in advance, so then I make my diary fit round it. And we go a lot to Glyndebourne, and I heard Tristan and Isolde for the first time there, and it's most wonderful production in a boat with blue colours. And we got to this middle act, and it was, as I described it at the time, this love duet, knee-knocking. I just thought it was so beautiful.
I saw one production where it became even more powerful because they never actually touched.
Oh.
And it was almost mind-blowing, because and I think that the point of that was that it encompassed this sort of difficulty in actually bringing this love together.
Yes, how beautiful.
Oh,
that almost encapsulates what Wagner is about, those building waves, but also the fact you somehow don't want it to ever to stop.
Mm. Yes.
Which is probably why people can sit through The Ring endlessly and still get pleasure from it.
There's always something new to hear that I hadn't heard before.
It is almost like a religious experience, isn't it, in a sense?
I suppose it is. I'll think about that as I sit through the 16 hours.
The love duet from Act 2, Scene 2 of Wagner's Tristan und Isolde, Placido Domingo and Deborah Voigt with the orchestra of the Royal Opera House, Covent Garden, conducted there once again by Antonio Pappano. So your career took off, Sally Davis, and you rose through the ranks of the health service, leaving, therefore, everyday doctoring behind. And then you were appointed 3 years ago England's chief medical officer. But you said that, in a way, it was all a kind of mistake, that you almost feel like an imposter.
Yes. The imposter syndrome is particularly prevalent in women, where you wonder whether you can do it, and I clearly can, but there's also the how do you do it? And I've been much entertained by many men as I've gone through my career who are great at bullshitting, and I've always thought the bullshit gene is on the Y chromosome.
I'll be very careful from now on.
Thank you.
Well, the next piece might come as a bit of a surprise. Actually, it's something I adore. It's Freddie Mercury and Queen and Bohemian Rhapsody.
It's very important to me. I love the music, but it is about a man dying of AIDS and the tussle he faces between the pain and the not wanting to leave, but actually asking for release. And one of the issues about AIDS that I think is very important was I hoped it would bring the public awareness of the limits of medicine to light, that we can't cure everything. People believe, they go off to the doctor expecting cure of everything. And with antimicrobial resistance on the rise, we're seeing that again.
The extraordinary thing about Freddie, who we're about to hear, is that he looked the picture of health for so long, the picture of absolute burning energy.
Yes. I was introduced to it by a gay couple who kept me sane over the years of being a diplomat's wife. And yes, he's very special, isn't he?
Is this the real life? Is this just fantasy? Caught in a landslide, no escape from reality. Open your eyes, look up to the skies and see. I'm just a easy come, easy go, little high, little low. Any way the wind blows doesn't really matter to me, to me.
Mama just killed a man. Didn't mean
Scaramouche, will you do the fandango?
Thunderbolt and lightning, very, very frightening me.
Galileo, Galileo,
Galileo, Figaro,
Magnifico.
Oh, I'm just a poor boy, nobody loves me.
He's just a poor boy from a poor family, sparing his life from this monstrosity.
Easy come, easy go, will you let me go?
Bismillah, no, we will not let you go.
Let him go!
Bismillah, we will not let you go.
Let him go!
Bismillah, we will not let you go.
Let me go!
We'll not let you go.
Let me go!
We'll not let you go.
Let me go!
Oh, mamma mia, mamma mia!
Mamma mia, let me go! Beelzebub has a devil put aside for me. For me.
Isn't it beautiful? And it's operatic as well, I realise.
Well, of course, it comes from A Night at the Opera, the album that was Bohemian Rhapsody by Freddie Mercury and Queen. The thing I love about it is that, you know, every now and then, we always think of pop music as being essentially around about three chords. And every now and then, Beach Boys, Beatles, Queen and Freddie come up with something which turns that on its head and surprises you and still is very popular.
Yes.
I think that's an extraordinary achievement. So, do you still manage to get to listen to music quite a bit?
Less than I should, because just sitting here even this morning, I realised that I listen to the music, I can feel the stress draining away. So clearly, for my soul, I need to listen to more than I do. But, yes.
That's very interesting what you said just now, because one of the important things about the arts in society, I think, it's not simply the kind of economic return, but it's the social return, that if children are able to express their emotions in a kind of abstract way through music, that they might possibly become calmer, more tranquil, and that we therefore might have a more peaceful society. Or is that just hopeful thinking?
No, there's some good evidence about all the arts. I mean, the music plays a role for developing children, and there is evidence that they get better academic endpoints. There's very good evidence about elderly people, about music calming them. Creativity is important to our souls.
Do you manage to listen, I mean, during holiday times, for example?
Yes, yes. When I go on holiday, one of the pleasures is listening to music and reading books. And this Brahms sextet is one that I take on holiday quite often to listen to.
Thank you.
part of the Brahms sextet, the very relaxing Allegro ma non troppo. I can see why you might find that very good to have on a holiday, Sally Davis. And of course, if you forget to take your CD to France, you can always download the programme from the Radio 3 website.
Yes.
The first movement from Brahms's sextet was played by the Raphael Ensemble. Every week there's some kind of health scare, and you must sometimes almost dread opening the papers to wonder what you're going to have to comment on. And I guess also it must be quite hard when the things that you feel don't entirely fit with government policy, because you're always treading that line. You were young at university in the 70s. I was a student just before that.
Yes, it is difficult. I never smoked, so I couldn't smoke joints, but I did have some cookies. Until on the third or fourth occasion, I had hallucinations and I've never touched it since. And I think I understood through that what my father said to me when I told him I was going to try it. He said, drugs decivilize you. You stop being a civilized person. And I understood why so many people were against even the soft drugs. So, like the fact I do enjoy wine. I'm open about my past.
But as a doctor, do you essentially see it as a medical problem rather than a criminal one?
Well, of course it's a medical problem. I mean, addiction is a medical problem and it becomes a public health problem. And then our society is choosing to treat that as a criminal justice issue.
When you are at home listening possibly to Private Passions on a Sunday, but probably in the kitchen, because I gather you're a very enthusiastic cook.
I love cooking. It's another way of relaxing. It takes enough thought to stop me worrying too much. And it's something we do as a family. My younger daughter, aged 18, is the most wonderful baker. I'm not, but we create great meals between us and then sit down together as a family with friends, whoever's around. I actually think the process of breaking bread and sharing food together is very important in bonding, be it of the family, the greater friends, or even with work people.
It's a bit like the communion that you get playing music together or singing in a choir.
Yes, it is. And I suppose, I hadn't thought about it before, the Last Supper is not just the Christian bit, but it is that sharing of food and wine and what that means.
And I think this final piece sums this all up for you, doesn't it?
Well, yes, I chose this piece because it was one of the first operas I went to. I studied it for O-level music, and then it was the first opera I went to with my wonderful husband, so it makes me think of him.
So this, then, is for your husband, Willem, and it's from Mozart's The Magic Flute, a duet about the pleasure of marriage.
Yes. I often pinch myself and say, is this really my life? I mean, to have a job that's endlessly fascinating, that can make a real difference. I have very strong values. Everything I've done, it is to try and make the world a better place. That may not be fashionable at the moment, but that's my driver. And then here I am with the most wonderful third husband, two healthy, fantastic children. I mean, I am blessed. I lead the most wonderful life.
Well, Sally Davis, this has been a great pleasure. Many thanks.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
So it is a woman's duty.
Man in Search of Truth and Beauty, the duet from Act 1, Scene 2 of Mozart's The Magic Flute, performed by Rebecca Evans and Simon Keenly's side, with the London Philharmonic Orchestra conducted by Sir Charles McCarris. Michael Barclay was talking to Dame Professor Sally Davis, the Chief Medical Officer for England. And there's a free download of that programme and indeed previous editions if you go to the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website. Michael's guest next week is Stephen Burkhoff. Private Passions was produced by Elizabeth Burke and the series is a Loftus production for BBC Radio 3.
Berlioz, Mendelssohn, Bach and Beethoven with the Scottish Chamber Orchestra and one of this year's featured Proms artists, the pianist Stephen Huff. Liszt astounded Mendelssohn by sight-reading his first piano concerto in a piano showroom in Paris in 1831. How will Stephen Huff fare with hopefully a little more preparation time? I'm Martin Handley. Join me at the BBC Proms tomorrow night at 7 o'clock.
This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. It's 1 o'clock and this is David Cornett with a summary of the news. Egypt's interim foreign minister Nabil Fahmy has said it was necessary for the security forces to move against anti-government demonstrators last week because the protesters were trying to undermine the foundations of the state. There have been 4 days of violence in which hundreds of people have been killed. The Egyptian cabinet is meeting and is expected to discuss a proposal to ban the Muslim Brotherhood, whose members support the deposed president Mohamed Morsi. Sussex police are investigating allegations that a woman had been planning to take her husband to the Dignitas Centre in Switzerland, which helps people to take their own lives. A woman of 65 from the Chichester area and a man of 25 have been arrested on suspicion of encouraging or assisting a suicide. The government says it's committed to keeping the cost of the high-speed rail project, HS2, under control. It follows a warning that it could cost more than £80 billion, almost double the current estimate. The free market think tank, the Institute for Economic Affairs, has said the extra costs could come from lobbying by local councils for extra infrastructure. Spanish fishermen have been protesting against the building of an artificial reef near the disputed British territory of Gibraltar. The fishermen claim that the concrete reef can snare their nets. Gibraltar's government says the reef protects fish stocks from being overexploited. A German tourist has been killed in Venice after the gondola he was travelling in collided with a water bus. The 50-year-old man was with his family near the Rialto Bridge. It's thought he became wedged between the boats as he tried to save his 3-year-old daughter. Chinese state media says the trial of the disgraced politician Bo Xilai on charges of bribery, corruption and abuse of power will start on Thursday. His downfall was triggered by a series of scandals, including the murder of the British businessman Neil Hayward in 2011. And the weather, dry and bright across the UK, with very strong winds across parts of Northern Ireland and Scotland. A few showers are likely, but it'll be mild, with temperatures ranging from 16 to 23 degrees. BBC News and Weather at 2 minutes past one. And time now here on BBC Radio 3 for the Early Music Show, presented by Catherine Bott.
O Lord, open thou my lips, and my mouth shall show forth thy praise. 17th century German music by Heinrich Schütz from his Symphonie Sacrae of 1629. That was Domine Labia Mea Aperies, sung by soprano Barbara Borden and tenor Douglas Nasuari with Concerto Palatino. Expressive and uplifting, but quite old-fashioned music for its time, given all the exciting stuff that was going on the other side of the Alps in Italy. There were two good reasons for this. First, the Thirty Years' War, whose origins would require a whole programme to elucidate or indeed justify. It ran from 1618 to 1648, with consequences that covered much of modern Europe. Vast tracts of land laid waste, economies ruined, death and destruction of property, and with severe cultural consequences too. You could even say that in musical terms, Baroque style arrived very late in Germany because of that war. The other reason is tied in with Schütz, Germany's preeminent composer in the first half of the 17th century. The young Schütz went to Venice in 1609 and stayed for 4 years, studying with the elderly Giovanni Gabrieli. His great Italian master was insistent that a thorough grounding in all the traditional compositional principles was essential. Only when counterpoint held no more secrets could one begin to express oneself fully. Schütz returned home, eventually becoming court composer to the Elector of Saxony, and was always keen to pass on his Venetian-taught wisdom to his students, one of whom was the subject of today's early music show, Matthias Weckmann.